This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. On the program this afternoon, in this portion of the program, we're going to take a look at the immigrant experience of America's Jews. What was it like for the first Jews to arrive in America? How did American Jewish culture evolve? What have been the accomplishments of American Jews? And how have they contributed to American life? Our guest this afternoon is historian Beth Wenger. She is the author of The Jewish Americans, Three Centuries of Jewish Voices in America. The book is a companion to the three-part PBS documentary series produced by David Gruben that begins on WILL-TV, our companion station, tomorrow evening, Wednesday, January 9th at 8 o'clock. It continues on the following two Wednesdays, the 16th and 23rd at the same time, 8 p.m. Going back to the first settlement in 1654, the documentary and book chronicle 350 years of Jewish American history. They profile prominent men and women from all walks of life, from Louis Brandeis and Ruth Bader Ginsburg to Fanny Bryce, Albert Einstein, Hank Greenberg, Lenny Bruce, Betty Friedan, Saul Bellow, Louis B. Meyer, Bess Meyerson, Carl Reiner, and Sid Caesar. Listeners, I invite you to join our discussion this afternoon. You can join us with a telephone call. I look forward to your questions and comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Beth Wenger holds the Katz Family Chair in American Jewish History and is Associate Professor of History at the University of Pennsylvania, where she serves as Director of the Jewish Studies Program. In addition to the Jewish Americans, Professor Wenger is the author of New York Jews in the Great Depression, Uncertain Promise, that book published by Yale. The new book, The Jewish Americans, published by Doubleday. Again, the phone number is 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Wenger, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Well, an overarching question here, I guess. How similar to the narratives of other immigrant groups in America is the story of America's Jews?
Well, I would say to that, you know, of course, there are similar trajectories to every immigrant group in America in the sense of similar challenges of arrival, acculturation, language, the balancing of fitting into America with maintaining ethnic customs and traditions. You can see that in many, many immigrant groups, and that's a case where I think you can see the series and the book on American Jews as providing a kind of lens on America in general. But, of course, every group has its own unique customs, traditions, and culture.
Mm-hmm.
And American Jews are no different.
And also it seems to me that the story of American Jews, which is interesting, is that they come from many places.
Yes. And that's there are similar stories to be told about, for example, Catholics who come from many places as well. But certainly Jews are very different. Immigrant Jews are very different from one another. So it's not a monolithic story by any means.
Yeah. The book opens by telling us that America's first Jews found a great deal of freedom when they arrived in 1654, and while that was exhilarating, it also presented great challenges. Here I have so many questions to begin with. I'll start with a couple. Who were these first Jewish Americans, and where had they come from?
Well, the first Jews who came, and probably about 23 or so of them, come to New Amsterdam, later New York, in 1654, and they had been living in the city of Recife, which was, and they had been Dutch Jews who had settled in Recife after the Dutch had taken control of it. But then the Portuguese seized it from the Dutch. So had these Jews stayed there, they would have been subject at that time to the Inquisition. And so they left. Many went back to live in Holland, and a few came to the New World and to New Amsterdam, which was owned by the Dutch West India Company.
Yeah. Now, how free were they on American soil?
Look, there were certainly restrictions.
Yeah.
There were restrictions on things like public worship, office holding, certain economic rights had to be won piecemeal. And, of course, the conditions varied from colony to colony. So did they have complete freedom? No. Did they have greater freedom for the most part from the places from which they came? Yes, they did. Now, of course, Jews living in Amsterdam had lived in under a condition of greater privileges than many parts of Europe. But in the United States, those limitations fell relatively quickly in most places. So they had the freedom for the most part to do what they needed to do, which was make a living, do business, settle and live peacefully and without threat. So they certainly had that here.
Yeah. So all the challenges of making a new life, and that is the immigrant experience. How quickly did the population of Jews grow in New Amsterdam and elsewhere in the colonies?
Well, the truth is about Jews in the colonial period is they represent such a tiny proportion of the population that they really attract very little notice. It's really in the 19th century when the Jewish population starts to grow to be 100,000, then 200,000 by the time you get into the early 1800s, by the 1830s, 40s, 50s. You're talking about a community that's beginning to reach into the 200,000.
Yeah. Well, in the early days, being a member of this minority and trying to hold together culturally and with one another was kind of tough. Maybe you tell us the story about Abigail Franks and the estrangement of her from her daughter.
Yes, Abigail Franks, and I should say she was a member of quite, an elite family. The Franks were really a merchant family living in New York. But they maintained Jewish traditions quite seriously. And they also were quite exceptional in educating their children, including their daughters, both religiously and what we would call today secularly. One of her daughters married a non-Jew, a prominent member of a Protestant family, and his name was Oliver DeLancey. And essentially, Abigail disowned her daughter. I mean, never spoke to her again after that. And in many, she was an avid letter writer, so we know a lot about her in her life. And she was in great turmoil over this decision. And from what we know, they never reconciled. And it's a story about intermarriage that speaks to one of the things that happens when you live in a free society, which is that people who would not have married and socialized in a different context are able to do so. So I really think in many ways this is a consequence of freedom.
Mm.
And it also shows how well integrated Jews were at a very, very early period.
Mm. What was the status of Jewish women in America in the 17th and 18th centuries?
Well, Jewish women, first of all, were mostly in the home and keeping religious traditions alive when they did in those families. They might help their husbands in business, but it was usually not publicly recognized that they were working, so to speak. Where Jewish women begin to get an avenue into more public life in the Jewish world comes first in education. The book has a section on Rebecca Gratz from Philadelphia, who sets up the first Sunday school and actually helps others in other cities set up Sunday schools. And this is not so different than non-Jewish women. And then, of course, their first entries into other kinds of public life come in benevolent societies and later charitable organizations, and most of that also gets going in the 19th century.
Mm. And then, of course, in the late 19th century and the early 20th century and well into the 20th century and continuing today, very active.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the book chronicles the, you know, with the wave of East European immigrants, where Jewish women are on the front lines in the labor movement, in strikes. They're quite active as women in the forefront of Jewish politics. And, of course, that's a thread in many ways that continues through the book, that you see later with, you know, Betty Friedan, with the women who became rabbis. It's not a continuous thread in that you can't, it would be anachronistic to project that back. But certainly you can see a strain of political life and public life that goes through American Jewish history where women are often at the forefront of change.
Mm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, historian Beth Wenger. She is the author most recently of The Jewish Americans, Three Centuries of Jewish Voices in America. The book is a companion to the three-part PBS documentary series that begins on WILL-TV, our companion station, tomorrow evening, Wednesday the 9th at 8 o'clock. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments for our guest. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. We have a couple of listeners ready to talk with us. Let's go first to Urbana, line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes. I was wondering, were these early Dutch Jews Sephardic or Ashkenazi?
They were Sephardic. In fact, the culture, the initial immigrants to the colonies and then the United States were mostly Sephardic, although I should say as early as the 1790s, they begin to be outnumbered by Ashkenazic Jews. However, the early institutions, for example, the five synagogues that exist in the colonial period up and down the East Coast, those are all Sephardic synagogues.
That's interesting. I knew there was a very large migration from Spain after the expulsion into Northern Europe, particularly Prussia, but the Netherlands as well.
Yes, well, those Jews who are in the Netherlands, who are in Amsterdam, some of them in London, they had come from Spain. Mm-hmm. Most of them had come from Spain and then settled there and then came to the United States.
That's interesting. They would have brought that brilliant culture with them.
Well, they did bring strong aspects of that culture with them. I mean, we know a little bit about, for example, some of the reading habits of those Jews from their libraries, and certainly many of the more educated of them, we can tell, are very connected to that culture.
Well, thank you. Sounds like an interesting talk.
Thanks. Thanks for the call this afternoon. Next, we go to a listener on a cell phone, line 4, the toll-free line, calling in from Piatone this afternoon. Good afternoon.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. Very interesting program. Was just wondering if your author covered a gentleman by the name of Bernard Baruch. I had picked up a book not too long ago and read about his colorful history, and I kind of rubbed elbows with the elite, and I was just wondering if there was anything you could add or say about him, and I'll go ahead and listen off-air. Thanks.
There's not a lot on Bernard Baruch. There are others who are part of his circle who are in the book. I should say he's mentioned in a less flattering way in some of the anti-Semitic literature that's prevalent in the 1930s, when many groups label the New Deal the Jew Deal, and he's one of the advisors that's often linked in that chain. So, he was certainly very, very, very prominent, and much could be said about him. I have to say, in writing the book, a good deal ended up on the cutting room floor because of space. You know, there's so many people who could be represented at length that are not, I must say.
Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign, line 2. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I want to make one comment about the first questioner, just to bring something up, since you mentioned Spanish Jews, or Sephardic Jews. There's also my understanding, and I don't know if you cover this, is that there is thoughts about Spanish Jews, some who were, what should I say, hidden Jews, who went to the Southwest with the Spanish settlements in what's now New Mexico and other parts of the Southwest. And that's something I wonder if you cover. But I've got a second question, which I'm much more interested in. I grew up in a Jewish immigrant community, first generation for the most part, which is was a primarily Hasidic community. And that community's primary concern is not to become integrated into American life. And by that I mean to maintain their separation within the larger structure of American economic and social life, but to keep themselves separate. And one of the things you started to talk about is how integrated Jews were in American life. But I think a more fundamental question, for at least from the perspective of the Hasidic point of view and from the Orthodox point of view, is whether becoming integrated in American life is good or bad. And I wonder if you explore that and explore those communities, what should I say, separation while being in America, which continues to this day. In fact, they're flourishing, I would say.
Yes, let me answer the second question first. The book treats very briefly Hasidic Jews. There's not a lot of emphasis on that, although, again, there's a lot to be said. What I would say to your question is that one of the choices in a free society is not to participate in every aspect of that society. I mean, I don't think we think about that as one of the aspects of American culture, but absolutely it is, and we see it more and more in many groups, not only Jews. And Hasidic Jews are a very good example of that choice to compartmentalize. But let's also not pretend that Hasidic Jews are not part of American culture in those aspects where they choose to be, meaning they will lobby politically for things that benefit their community. We've seen even, you know, Supreme Court cases on certain issues. Street signs in Yiddish in some of these neighborhoods, that doesn't get there without some connection to the American political world, all in the service of remaining separate. So that is an aspect of American Jewish life and of American life that I think is very important. Briefly to your first question, I don't write about it a lot, but this issue of Jews who in the Southwest, many of them, in fact, lived as Christians. They had converted forcibly, many of them continue to live as Christians, and some have later traced their roots back, some have gone back to Judaism, some have not, but it's a very interesting phenomenon studied at length, especially in those areas.
Well, thank you very much. I would question some of your comments about the Hasidic community, because even though they make use of American life, in many ways they live as if they were still in Europe, and in some ways they're like the Amish and some of the other groups that we have here in the Midwest.
I agree with you. I completely agree with that. But what the point I'm trying to make is that American culture makes that choice possible.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Next, we talk with a listener in Urbana. Line one, hi.
Hello.
Hi.
It's a wonderful program. I'm really enjoying it. I wonder if you ran across a story that I heard back in the mid-1970s. Family friends of mine lost a court case that went all the way to the Supreme Court when they were asking for reimbursement. This was a case that had been brought again and again for reimbursement for money that was lent to finance the American Revolution back in Boston. And they finally lost the case, not because it was proved an incorrect case, but because the government said they couldn't possibly afford to repay it.
Yes. Now, I don't know if what you're talking about is Sky and Solomon. Is that the case?
That's correct.
Okay. That's what I thought. This has a long, long history. I only write about it fleetingly in the book, but this is actually, you asked me a question about something I have studied and I'm writing about in another context, so I know a good deal about this. Chaim Solomon was a financier, a broker, who is often called the financier of the revolution. In fact, in 1976, there was a postage stamp issued that says on the bottom, financier of the revolution. He was
owed by the family. That was a mild apology for the millions of dollars that they were owed.
Yeah. Now, I have to say that the fact is he was a broker. He helped to secure notes of credit that, in fact, did keep the Revolutionary Army, that funded the army, that provided, you know, everything they needed to keep the battle going. That is very much the case. And he did die impoverished, as did many others who held notes of credit because they just became no good in the new economy. I mean, he wasn't the only individual who helped to finance the revolution. There were many. And it's become quite a story, embellished a little bit with some mythology around it, and really it went on, and this story of Chaim Solomon went on and on and on for many years, for centuries, actually, with various attempts to reimburse him, all that failed, attempts to get a medal for him. There are some monument attempts, some that fail, some that succeed. There actually are monuments to Chaim Solomon in Chicago and in Los Angeles. So it's a very long story, some of which has been embellished, but certainly he was an important financier for the revolution.
Well, I look forward to reading more about it.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Is that coming out in book form or is it an article? Or
It is out in an article, but it's it will be in a forthcoming book that I'm writing.
Okay.
Called History Lessons, The Invention of American Jewish Heritage, which I hope to submit to Princeton University Press in the next year or so and have that come out. Probably won't be a while, but I'm working on it.
Good. Well, maybe we'll have the privilege and the pleasure of talking with you again down the road. We've touched a little bit on the revolution now, and I thought it was interesting to read in the book the correspondence of a congregation in Newport to President George Washington and his reply. You want to talk about those two letters that you included in the book?
Yes, these are actually very oft-quoted letters, even when people don't know exactly where they came from. As George Washington made many trips, I should say, around the United States, trying to unify the nation, you know, obviously a newly created nation, trying to balance how to respect minority group interests in the nation. He traveled around, and many congregations wrote him letters. In fact, other synagogues wrote him letters. This is the most famous in many ways because of the wording that's in the letter that the Newport congregation writes, you know, to bigotry no sanction, that phrase. And in many ways, and then Washington repeats those words verbatim in his reply. And in many ways, that phrase itself became almost an unofficial charter that Jews took upon themselves to, as a way of saying, these are our rights. You know, this is what we have in this country. You know, to bigotry, no sanction; to persecution, no assistance. And really is quoted over and over and over as a way for Jews to say, you know, this is the pledge of the country that we live in now.
Mm. Were there instances of anti-Semitism in the Young Republic?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
There were many. And you know, I could certainly list them. There was certainly some economic discrimination. There was some degree of social exclusion that persisted for a very, very long time. And, you know, for example, I have a letter in here from Jonas Phillips, who writes about, who actually asserts his rights in the nation, and you can see there also that even when in the absence of a specific threat, there's often a fear of what might happen, a sort of insecurity, let's see how this nation works out for us. But what I would also say about anti-Semitism is that, comparatively speaking, it's always been weaker in the United States than other places that Jews had lived. There are horrific events. I mean, what's one that's treated in the film and also in the book is the lynching of Leo Frank, which happens in the 20th century.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, an aberration in American Jewish history, but it happened.
Yeah. What was happening in Atlanta, Georgia in 1915?
Well, you know, briefly, the story with him is that a young girl, white Christian girl, was murdered in the pencil factory that he owned in Atlanta. And he ended up, after a long court case, and being convicted. In fact, he was later posthumously pardoned, and it turns out that probably the African-American janitor was probably the one who committed the murder. But it says something that in the context of, you know, 1913 to 1915 South, they were willing to accuse and convict a white man rather than an African-American. And that really says something for the time. And eventually, the governor commuted his sentence to life in prison, and before he could be transferred, he was abducted by a mob and lynched in Atlanta. And it was really a shock to the system for American Jews, and that kind of physical violence and murder did bring up many fears. But again, the thing that I want to say about it is that, as horrific as it is, and it certainly is, it's the aberration, it's the exception, not the rule. And I don't mean to paint a rosy picture. There are times, and the book chronicles throughout American Jewish history cases of, this is the most violent by far. But for example, in the middle of the Civil War, when General Grant expels from portions of three southern states Jews wholesale because he accused them of illicit trading that was hurting the war effort. Now, this is also quite frightening for Jews because the notion of expulsion again, this is precisely the fears these things bring up. But what's the end of that story? Delegates go, they meet with President Lincoln, he overturns the order. So there are many ways you could tell that story. You could tell the portion, and all are true, you could tell the portion of it where Jews are still singled out as a class, which is very distressing, even in the mid-19th century. But you could also tell the portion where, in the United States, there's recourse, there's lobbying, and it's successful. So the point I'm trying to make is anti-Semitism is a very real dynamic throughout the course of American Jewish history, and in many different ways, it has many different manifestations. But comparatively speaking, this is a nation that offered Jews greater freedoms and certainly a more peaceful life than they had had anywhere else that they had lived.
Mm. Let's take another call now. Listener waiting for us in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. I don't know if this has been covered or not, because I came into this program a little bit late. In terms of colleges and universities, whether in the 40s or whatever, Jews had difficulty certainly in, you know, being accepted. I understand. Now, again, I can stand corrected on this. Major universities. And I think how many universities, I think Roosevelt University is one, this is 1945, that, you know, certainly administrators and all that sort of, were started by a number of Jews, or, you know, and was one of the, how many other colleges were and universities were like this, do you know?
Well, let me start with the first part of your comment. The note, I think what you're talking about is the imposition of Jewish quotas at many universities.
That would have, okay, all right.
And that really is a phenomenon of the interwar years, the 1920s and 30s especially, when many universities begin thinking that their campuses are becoming too Jewish. And, in fact, the book contains a great exchange of letters. You know, most of this is unofficial when universities do it. Harvard's president, his name was A. Lawrence Lowell in the 20s, he actually publicly said, you know what, we're going to limit Jewish enrollment because I believe this will decrease anti-Semitism. And there's a Cleveland attorney, a Harvard alum, named Alfred Benesch, who writes him a letter, and there's an exchange, and basically points out the faulty logic of this plan. And Lowell writes back, and there's an exchange that ends up being published in the press. And I've reproduced that exchange here, which I think is actually one of the more interesting pieces in the book. What happens by the 40s is many of those, post-World War II, the 40s and the 50s, these kinds of quotas end up being dropped. But you're right, there are universities, some, I don't know how many colleges are really set up this way. You know, the place where Jews could go at these times were public universities. You know, City College in this period is, in New York, for example, has an overwhelmingly Jewish population. So there are places where Jews can go. And what does happen, what you're suggesting in the example of universities, I think, is what Jews do during this period, because, of course, higher education isn't the only place where Jews are barred. They're barred from businesses, law firms, medical practices, hospitals, and they respond often by setting up their own law firms, medical practices, businesses, and creating a kind of almost ethnic subculture that allows them the possibility for mobility in a period of occupational discrimination. And that's true for some universities, too.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is historian Beth Wenger. We're talking with her about her book, The Jewish Americans, Three Centuries of Jewish Voices in America. So we're talking today about the immigrant experience of America's Jews. The book, The Jewish Americans, is a companion to a three-part PBS documentary series produced by David Gruben that begins this month in January of 2008. And it begins on our companion station, WILL TV, tomorrow evening, Wednesday the 9th at 8 o'clock, and it continues on the following two Wednesdays, the 16th and 23rd at the same time, 8 p.m. Our guest, Beth Wenger, is a faculty member of the University of Pennsylvania, where she holds the Katz Family Chair in American Jewish History and is Associate Professor of History at the university. She also serves as the Director of the Jewish Studies Program at the University of Pennsylvania. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. The great wave of immigration in the late 19th and 20th, the 20th century, were the people coming, the Jews coming to America at this point, were they readily assimilated into American Jewish life?
They were, I would say, pretty quickly. You know, there's been a lot written about the division between the so-called German Jews, who really aren't only German, they come from many places in Central Europe, and the East Europeans, who come from Russia and Poland. And there certainly is a cultural divide, and there's some of the aid, immigrant aid given, is given with a little bit of condescension, certainly, and it's received with a little bit of resentment sometimes. But actually, newer scholarship on this relationship has at least softened that stark contrast enough to say, yes, there was some hostility between the two groups. But there was also a lot of commitment to helping fellow Jews. And even if it didn't always come through quite the way it was intended, that's important. You know, it's important that there was that commitment. Now, what the fact is, the so-called German Jews are fearful that these millions of poor Yiddish-speaking Jews, you know, pouring into America, would threaten their relatively newly won status. And there is, of course, not only against Jews, there's an anti-immigrant backlash in this period, as many Americans begin to fear that the, you know, the social order of the United States is being destroyed by these foreigners. And having said all that, if you think about the acculturation of Jews, it happens in a generation. I mean, it's fast. And certainly the children of immigrants, you know, are rabid consumers of all sorts of aspects of American culture, and so are immigrants themselves, even if they are always a little bit more distant from American culture than their children. You know, we know that, I mean, just to give one small example, one thing that immigrants do is almost as soon as they come off the boat, we have just millions of these photographs that Jews, the first thing they do is they get an American clothing, you know, a new suit for men, and they have their picture taken, and they often send it back home to their relatives as a sign of their transformation into American, into American culture. And we know that, for example, Jews, immigrant Jews, bought pianos on the installment plan right away, trying to become cultured, trying to become, to aspire to a life that they wanted. So I think there are ways in which that immigrant Jews really right away try to become American. And at the same time, there's a back-and-forth process to that. Their culture becomes largely a piece of American culture, and that's represented in the book, too, with the entertainers, the vaudeville, you know, the Nickelodeons, which become the movie industry, and you know, so it's a two-way process, for not just with Jews, with all immigrant groups.
Tell us just a little bit about the Bintel, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Brief.
Yes, the Bintel Brief.
The Bintel Brief, okay.
Which is an advice, I mean, it means literally bundle of letters in Yiddish, and it's a column in the Jewish Daily Forward. The Jewish Daily Forward is the most popular of all the Jewish newspapers. And by the way, there was a thriving Jewish press. You know, there was a paper for anarchists, for Orthodox Jews had their own papers, and socialists of all different varieties, and, you know, secular Jews of all varieties had a different paper. But the Forward, which was a socialist paper, was the most successful, had the greatest circulation, and they had a regular advice column where people would write. It was like a Dear Abby kind of column, and people would write in about all sorts of problems, romantic issues, economic issues, political issues, and the editors would write back and with words of wisdom for them, and you really get a kind of a nice snapshot of the everyday concerns of immigrant Jews in those columns.
Yeah.
And I should say throughout the Forward, which is just such a revealing glimpse at what immigrant culture really is. I have to say one of the other, not in the Bintel Brief, but one of my favorite pieces in the book comes from the Forward, where it's a column where the editors try to explain the American game of baseball to immigrant Jews who read the paper. And I mean, I won't try to quote it here, but anyone who reads the book, you'll see that it is the most convoluted explanation in the world. It's quite clear that they understand very little about the game of baseball, but this, again, was part of what the paper wanted to do. This is how you become an American. You have to learn about baseball, which is the quintessential American game, and you have to learn how to American habits and American foods and manners and all that.
Yeah, who's on first?
Well, it reads like who's on first.
Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign, line one. Hi.
Hi, yeah, I'm on second.
Anyway, my very favorite American Jew is Abraham Flexner, who had a private secondary school or prep school in Louisville, I believe, and then spent a great amount of time helping correct what was a very deplorable medical school situation in the country. But is there an inclusion of education and medical? I'm even remembering the Mount Sinai Hospital in Chicago, kind of an important place, I thought.
It is, and Abraham Flexner is very interesting. I agree, and indeed he is from Louisville. Unfortunately, he's not represented in the book, and I don't have anything per se on hospitals or medical education. It's a very interesting field, and we were talking earlier about the fact that Jewish hospitals get created largely because of discrimination against Jews. And there's the string of hospitals all over the United States is a good example of that. I wish I had had time to include that. I agree that it's very interesting. There's not much in the book about that.
I want to thank the listener for his call. Can you tell us a little bit about Abraham Flexner?
Well, he was employed by the Rockefeller Foundation. I mean, I'm speaking off the top of my head now, if I recall, for about 30 years, the beginning of the 20th century. He did found a private school, that with a kind of innovative educational flavor. He believed in things that we still believe in today, small classes, hands-on attention, and many of his ideas went into forming a lot of the ways that we think about education. He also went on to talk about medical education, in much the same way. And so a lot of our ideas about how education should function come from him. And he was also involved, I believe, with Louis Bamberger in founding the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton and headed it in the 1930s.
Hmm. Was there an individual you came across doing this project that had been unknown to you that you were especially pleased to make his or her acquaintance?
That was unknown to me.
Given your background as a scholar of Jewish history and American Jewish history, you really know your stuff.
Well, I can't say that many of the figures were, certainly the people who were the most famous were not, were people known to me, of course. And so that surprised me, less. I will say that some of the more interesting things I came across were in looking for average voices, because it was very important to me not to make this book a chronicle of the famous. The famous are there. They're plenty well represented. But, I'll give you one example. I wanted to have some piece in there from an American soldier who had fought in World War II, because World War II is really a transformative event for many American Jews who fight in very, half a million Jews fight in the war, because so many more are here and are citizens than in earlier wars, and it brings them into contact with non-Jews, sometimes for the first time from people across the country they'd never met, and vice versa, by the way. A lot of non-Jews meet Jews for the first time in the army. In any case, I wanted something from a soldier, and there are collections of works of letters from soldiers, and I found one, and he's in the book. His name is Joseph Fiza. He's the son of, like many who fought, the son of immigrants, was an electrician with his father, and to have the rights to this letter, I had to look for the family. And I found the family basically by cold calling and by all kinds of luck. And after an initial conversation and promising I wasn't, you know, selling anything or running a scam. And they could check me out at the University of Pennsylvania as being reputable. I got in touch with them and ended up having many email conversations, you know, with them and phone conversations, and it enabled me to write a better introduction to the pieces. I got to know them and hear the full story of him and his life, and, you know, certainly I never would have come upon that had I not been writing this book.
Very interesting. There, we have to leave it. We're out of time. Beth Wenger, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you very much.
Beth Wenger is the author most recently of The Jewish Americans, 3 Centuries of Jewish Voices in America. The book is a companion to the 3-part PBS documentary series that begins this month on your public television station here in our market. It's WILL-TV, our companion station. It begins tomorrow evening, Wednesday the 9th at 8 o'clock. Our guest's book, The Jewish Americans, is published by Doubleday.